Hallo. Etwas Glück to go, bitte.
Gern. Zum Rubbeln oder Aufreißen?
Hauptsache schnell. Ich kann mein Glück kaum erwarten.
Die Lose von Lotto Bayern. Zum Rubbeln oder Aufreißen. Glück to go. Der schnelle Weg zum Glück. Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand. Nur in deiner Lottoannahmestelle.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Infos unter biök.de.
This comes from someone who claims to be a former forensic investigator that worked for a few precincts in upstate New York. To clarify, I have no personal ties to this person. Don't know why they specifically reached out to me, or felt this page was their only remaining option to tell their story. I'm simply passing along what they said, and will leave it to your own interpretation. After conducting my own research, however, I will say their theories are plausible, and whoever this is, genuinely believes they've uncovered something heinous. Here's the account I received, told in their point of view. I worked as a forensic investigator in New York State's Delaware and Columbia counties. I've seen my fair share of crime scenes, from young suicides at ages they had no business of even entertaining such thoughts, to gruesome accidents and murder victims killed in the worst way imaginable. There were three particular cases whose backstories compelled me to dig deeper, even after the official investigations concluded. What I found made me question the extensive reality, human depravity, and avarice. The first happened in East Chatham, December 1986. A teen, who I'll refer to as Will, murdered four of his family members, seeming to be driven by financial gain. All four bodies were discovered in their bedrooms, dying from gunshot wounds to the head. Despite being described as a shallow, detached individual, Will excelled in school and was thought to have a bright future. His family was very active in the community and owned a successful business, which made these murders especially stunning. The teen readily confessed when questioned, but wasn't very forthcoming on certain crime scene details. Dozens of candles placed on top of coins scattered around the house, inscriptions written in blood on the living room floor, most of which we couldn't document because they were repeatedly tracked over before we arrived, and the bodies all being smeared with an oily light green substance. The coroner reports on all four bodies describe their wounds as narrow bullet-shaped holes entering through the victim's forehead and exiting through the back. The exit wounds looked nothing like those made by bullets. No casings or rounds were found, and tests for gunpowder residue were instantly damaged at a lab by a pipe burst. While the official report said all four victims died from gunshots, it was technically never proven. Thinking they had sufficient evidence, detectives saw no reason to investigate further after Will confessed, and overlooked these bizarre details. Although they determined Will, who claimed to have no recollection of that night, suffered a psychotic breakdown, I always suspected he had an ulterior motive. Any attempts at deciphering what was written on the living room floor were futile, except for one semi-legible phrase. Judoc. J-U-D-O-C. The light green slippery substance slathered on all four bodies was also identified as money oil, a herbal remedy used in witchcraft that supposedly brings prosperous wealth. Although many acknowledged there was a lot more going on, everyone ultimately wanted to move forward and minimize the attention East Chatham was receiving from this tragedy. In the end, I understood the desire to put this dark chapter of East Chatham's history behind us, and eventually accepted I wouldn't learn any more about what happened than what was already known. Fast forward a few years when I was working in Delaware County. The second case happened in June 1989. Another mass murder that conjured up memories of East Chatham. A 23-year-old, I'll call Evan, murdered his family at their cabin outside Stamford. Lit candles placed on top of coins littered the home, where four bodies were found in the house's attic. Initially perceived as gunshots, the autopsy report explained their wounds being bullet-shaped entrances that went completely through the victim's body. Unlike the East Chatham killings, these murder victims contained several deep perforations. The bodies were centered around a strange symbol that seemed to depict a blocky, crookedly drawn uppercase B. A small backwards J protruded from the B's lower left corner, while a jagged uppercase T branched off its top left end. the emblem was drawn with a scorched powder that, based on samples recovered, had an initial light green colour and was composed of different herbs. It looked like Evan had been interrupted in the middle of whatever he was doing, prompting him to flee. He was cornered at an abandoned farm in a neighbouring county, which ensued a lengthy standoff. Before being gunned down after opening fire on police, officers on scene recalled Evan kept screaming he was so close and that he needed to complete the circle and finish the process. One bizarre piece of evidence was a black envelope Evan pinned on his family business storefront sometime after committing the murders. It was covered in green wax and contained burnt remnants of paper that, from what few strands were salvaged, appeared to be some kind of letter or note. Although Evan apparently had severe mental issues, this dismissive explanation for his appalling actions disregarded some alarming details. Evan was apparently obsessed with money and wealth, to the point where it influenced him at a cognitive level. He stood to assume his entire family's estate, which, according to friends of his, Evan incessantly pondered about the liquid value of, and what he'd do with all that cash. When I disputed the investigation's conclusions, my police chief gave a familiar explanation. "Evan's dead," he said. "No need to allocate time and resources to an already solved case." Even after noting every similarity with the East Chatham murders, he wouldn't entertain any further inquiries and eventually reassigned me to another division. It was after this I learned the powdery substance found in the attic was identified as money powder, which had many similar vegetal ingredients as its oleaginous counterpart, money oil. Despite violating orders and an abundance of department codes, I started my own secret investigation trying to connect these cases. There was too much overlap between them that I couldn't let this go without leaving no stone unturned. Both killings. Both were committed by young men with financial motives. They murdered their families in near identical manners. Candles placed on top of coins and substances made from the same material were found at both crime scenes. Although I was convinced Will and Evan were trying to perform the same or closely related rituals, my evidence was circumstantial at best. I needed a direct link connecting them that would give my theory the credence necessary to be taken seriously. About a year into my independent probe, a case from February 1988 in Groveland, New York, was brought to my attention. A man I'll call Larry murdered his whole family, then himself, and setting the whole house on fire. After extinguishing the blaze, police discovered 5 bodies. Larry killed his wife and 3 children, who were each found lying in their beds. Although gunshots were officially deemed all 5 victims' cause of death, Larry was the only one described as being explicitly caused by firearm. His wife and kids died from what the documents described as wounds closely resembling a gunshot that completely passed through the victim's cranial region. For me, there were 2 affirming details in this case that connected to the East Chatham and Stanford killings. Investigators determined the fire was started by lighting a charred black envelope. A note inside was too badly burned and no longer legible. But this envelope looked exactly like the one Evan pinned on his family's storefront. Larry also had a tattoo on his back, matching the symbol found at the Stanford scene. A jagged B with a smaller uppercase T and a backwards J stemming from its corners. I also discovered Larry and his wife were having marital problems, which derived from a crippling financial situation that put them on the precipice of ruin. Finding this case led to more chilling discoveries. One regarded an owl rope bracelet with a gold wolf head charm Larry had on his wrist. Will wore the exact same bracelet when he was found, which I neglected to mention earlier. Despite living in Groveland when murdering his family, Larry settled there fairly recently, having lived most of his life in Scotia County. Not only did he own a business in East Chatham from 1983 to 1985, where Will happened to work for 8 months, but the abandoned farmhouse where Evan made his final stand was on land formerly owned by Larry's family. I delved further into Larry's background. Although information was hard to come by, it led me to learning about lupus verdis, meaning green wolf in Latin. What little I found described them as some kind of fraternal order, where Larry was a member. The only other details I uncovered about Lupus Verdis was they were formerly headquartered in the now abandoned lodge located somewhere between Medusa and South Westerlo, roughly the midway point between East Chatham and Stamford. The lodge burned down in the summer of 1989, after which the organisation appeared to cease operations. The former lodge's dilapidated remains still stand today. I spent months trying to uncover more about Lupus Verdis, but had stagnant process and came to a barrage of dead ends. Shortly after, however, my rogue investigation was halted after being discovered by the DA's office. Although no charges were pressed, the police confiscated most of my documents and case files, after which I was swiftly terminated. A few years passed when something seemingly out of the blue happened that dragged me back down this rabbit hole. I woke up one morning to find hundreds of papers, which came from a filing cabinet filled with old files I still had on these cases that the police somehow missed, littered the room where they were kept. Written on every one of those papers was a word. Mammon. It was written in what appeared to be blood, and I initially neglected to mention the filing cabinet holding these documents was in my bedroom. I couldn't let anyone know these files were still in my possession, so I took to the internet, where I gained a lot of perturbing insight on the word's meaning. Mammon was a theological demonic entity representing greed and want, who promised his worshippers boundless wealth. I almost fell over after seeing Mammon's sigil, a distorted B with an uppercase T and a backwards J, jutting from his upper and lower left corners. It was the same symbol found in Will's attic and tattooed on Larry's back. This led me to read up on the different rituals for summoning Mammon. They varied in complexity, and many involved using specific items like candles, coins, owl rope, herbal remedies, like money oil and powder, along with writing letters and requests to Mammon that you burned or placed in black envelopes. I was especially bothered by a redundant detail of Mammon's appearance that was in quite a few visual depictions of the being. Many had Mammon brandishing a long, narrow spike that retracted from its wrist, which was used to impale his victims' bodies. The stories I read said Mammon extract people's souls in this grisly manner, which were added to a collection it amassed over the millennia. It made me think about the wounds every one of those cases' murder victims had, which every report was quick to write off as gunshots. What else could create that type of opening? Were those poor souls truly at rest, or suffering a far worse fate? Mammon also apparently frequented the form of a wolf, which made sense of the fraternal order being named Lupus Verdis and those owl rope bracelets worn by Will and Larry having wolf-head charms. I don't think the dates all three massacres occurred were randomly chosen. Will killed his family on December 13th, when the feast of St. Judoc is held. Judoc, the word we found written in the East Chatham crime scene, was a young wealthy prince who gave up his opulence to become a priest. He lived a life of modesty, solitude, and was said to be a staunch adversary of Mammon, since he stood against everything the demon represented. Apparently, using blood to write names of you or your deity's antagonists is a form of mockery and scorn in occultism that supposedly appeases and empowers your idol. The Stamford murders happened on June 22nd, which falls on the summer solstice, whose signified period of growth is considered an opportune time to summon certain beings, and when the season of Mammon begins. Larry's murder-suicide occurred on February 28, 1988, which fell on a leap year. In the dark arts, leap years are supposed to provide a window for spirits and other beings to enter our world. It's worth mentioning many works I read about or mentioned Mammon described him coming in and out of our world using these leap year portals. Having presented my facts, I'll now tell you what I believe happened. Lupus Verdis was secretly a cult dedicated to Mammon, whose members sought wealth and prosperity. Some rituals for summoning this being say flesh and blood offerings yielded greater rewards based on enormity. If done correctly and precisely, I suppose the magnitude of sacrificing one's family was thought to yield endless rewards from this being. Larry recruited Will and Evan, who became indoctrinated by the Order's teachings. My guess is Will failed to properly complete his ritual, causing him to undergo an irreversible mental breakdown, Evan appeared to have gotten interrupted while performing his, likely by police when they arrived at the house. Larry's situation was much less clear. He was overcome with grief, either for botching or coming to grips on what he was actually doing during his ritual, and ended his life in response. After how much publicity the Stanford killings got, Lupus Verdes probably decided to vacate the area or go underground, which could explain why their lodge burned. I expectedly made waves when trying to get my findings reviewed and investigated whether Lupus Verdes was still operating. I should have seen it coming, but anyone who gave me the time of day dismissed my report, saying the evidence was too disputable, circumstantial, and most insultingly of all, inventive. I eventually gave up when my former precincts threatened me with legal action for not turning over all the files and documents I still had, who said I was rehashing settled business that had no need to be revisited. Things settled down for a while afterwards, until something happened recently. I found a familiar-looking black envelope among some of my spouse's belongings while clearing out a room that we were renovating. After reading the recently dated letter it contained, I now know I'm not safe in my home, and have been closely watched by the people I've known and loved for years on behalf of a certain aforementioned organization. I don't know who to trust or where I'll go, but hope making this story known will help anyone that is, or suspects they're in a similar situation. This goes way deeper than expected, and those cases I used to put this puzzle together may only be the beginning of uncovering what other horrors this entity and his devout followers have committed. Let's get something straight before I start. I'm not and wasn't a peeping Tom. When I say I spied on my grandma in the shower, I mean once. One time. Singular. It wasn't something I did regularly as some kind of Freudian habitual neurosis. Trust me, once was enough. Spying on people wasn't a childhood preoccupation of mine. Okay, yes, I was spying on the family in the shower and had been for a few weeks before the grandma incident. But the goal wasn't to see their naughty parts. I was a normal kid, and the majority of my thoughts were on normal kid things like Cartoon Network and N64. It's important to me that you understand this. I was an innocent kid, even by the standards of most 7-year-olds. I ended up seeing what I saw because of reasons that were nothing to do with nudity and everything to do with a harmless jump scare prank. The incident happened in the summer of 98, the last summer where it wasn't just Dad and me. I was 7 years old, and like all 7-year-olds, had to come up with interesting ways to entertain myself through the 6-week break whenever parents were too busy to take me to the park or some other child-distracting place. One of the games I devised for myself that summer was Toilet Ghosts. The rules of the game were simple. Over the course of the summer, I was going to make my family, Mum, Dad and Grandma, believe that our bathroom was haunted. My room was right next to the bathroom. For those unfamiliar with the layout of industrial-era terraced houses in the UK, it might help to know that in most, the lavatory and shower bathtub share a space. The idea for Toilet Ghosts came to me when I was looking for something under my bed. That's when I found the hole. It was the sound of Dad grunting that alerted me to it. I was lining up my army men, ready to shoot with my Nerf gun, when I realized the sounds of straining coming through the old walls were much clearer under my bed than they should be. I was facing away from the wall at the time, so I looked behind me, towards where I knew the bathroom was. Down by my left foot, there was a section of wall missing. A perfect circle, roughly the diameter of a tennis ball. Now that I'm an adult, I realized it was where the toilet had been at one point, before a previous occupant decided to rearrange the plumbing. They'd done a rush job, which is why instead of filling the hole properly, they opted to file down the ceramic pipe on either side of the wall and plug up the gap with a loose-fitting half-brick. A half-brick that came loose easily with my tiny hands. My memories are the first time I peered through the mystery hole, as I initially thought of it, are almost as crystal clear as the last. The other side of the hole was at the base of the bathroom sink, behind where my mum kept the toilet brush and various bathroom cleaning products Dad had no idea how to use. From my vantage point, I could see almost the whole bathroom. In the dim light cast from the narrow porthole-style window on the opposite wall, I had a full view of the glistening off-white tiles, drab marble wallpaper, and of course, the shower. The toilet was about a foot to the right of the hole, so I couldn't see much of Dad but his ankles and toes. I watched his foot tap for a few minutes while he strained, holding my hand over my mouth to silence the gleeful chuckling at having a window into his private moment. He'd have no idea, were it not for my scream. As I was watching, still delighting in the secrecy and stealthiness of it all, something long and thin and hairy unfurled over the lip of the shaved pipe at the hole's other end. My eyes widened in horror as another and another and another of prickly limbs curled themselves around the rim, prodding and probing for my terrified features. My eyes bulged, heart hammering against my ribs. Then, before I could react, the furry, multi-limb monstrosity lunged at me. "Ah, get off! I hate spiders!" I squealed and rolled out from under the bed. The errant spider flew from my face, scuttling away to sulk in the distant corner of my bedroom. What few hairs were on my arms at that age stood up when I heard my dad's echoey cry from beneath the bed. "Jesus Christ, what in God's name was that? Susan? Susan, come up to the bathroom!" The deliciousness of the idea my 7-year-old mind put together in that moment excited me so much a lump caught in my throat. Toilet Ghost was born. Game on. So, that's the first half of the equation. You know about the hole and why I was looking down it. Now, you need to know the second half. You know how I was spying on her and why. But what you still don't know about is Grandma. This is where things stop getting so whimsical and innocent. It's been 23 years since I saw her, but I remember the ensemble more clearly than even my wedding day. When I tried to describe through tears the hell I'd been through between terms to the class, I didn't have a wide enough vocabulary to describe her accurately. I sputtered and sobbed words like monster, nightmares, and dead people smell. Now I'm older, I can do the creature that stalked my 7th summer more justice. Her skin was clay-like, mottled and almost grey, waxy to the touch and pudgy in texture. She was huge, with a waistline my 7-year-old self retold as being big enough to eat 10 of me. She'd sit in my dad's recliner all day, her many folds and bulges moving and shifting at tectonic speeds. Her face, though. Her face was something else. Botox was huge in the 90s. If you've ever seen a bad Botox job, you'll have a rough idea of the odd way my grandma's knobbled, swollen features moved far too little when she talked. I didn't know what nerve damage was at the time. My parents' explanations didn't do much to dispel comparisons in my brain made between her stiff features and the prosthetic creatures in the horror movie I'd given myself nightmares with the previous Christmas. What didn't help was her teeth. Her eyes were unsettling too, all sunken and dim and unmoving. But it was the bulky square canines and incisors that freaked me out so much it took me a week to look her in the face over the dining table. As I said, her teeth were square. Perfectly square. All of them. They ran uniform along her cement grey gums, each brilliant white postage stamp sized chunk of enamel placed at a perfect right angle with its neighbours. I think the teeth freaked Mum and Dad out too. At least the snippets of conversation I stole from echoes coming up the stairs seemed to suggest as such. "I've never seen her take them out if they are," was one that came up a lot, and "she didn't pack a toothbrush, Susan." They only mentioned them the nights before they smelled of wine and demanded I keep the TV volume low over breakfast though. I don't have many memories of Grandma before she moved on. I don't remember Grandpa. the man whose death was the catalyst to her joining our household at all. She'd only been living with us a few months at the time my father was the first unwilling Toilet Ghost contestant. I didn't know much about the elderly before she came to stay. I was glad to learn, as I grew older, that the bizarre and unsettling behaviour I witnessed that summer had nothing to do with ageing, and everything to do with her. I was too experienced with them to know that Grandma didn't act like other old people. She didn't really act like any people at all. She'd say odd things when I was alone in the room with her. The conversations she and my mum and dad had were nonsensical enough. When I was lying awake in bed at night, I'd hear snippets of arguments between my parents. Sentences like, "I know she's your mother, Susan, but she's balmy. Don's death broke her. It's not healthy for Michael. He matters too." And, "The doctor said it's early onset. It's only going to get worse, not better," would drift up the stairs. Words and phrases like dementia, Lewy body syndrome, and care home, the implications of which I wouldn't understand until I was older. The things Grandma used to say to me without my parents around were beyond the adult ramblings of a mind ravaged by a degenerative condition. Even as a kid, I knew the difference between confused nonsense and deliberate, malicious intent. "You know, if you tell anyone, I'll come for you," she hissed at me one afternoon while I was keeping myself occupied with a Lego set on the carpet. "If you say a word, I'll come for you and suck out the jelly insides of your precious little eyes through a straw." Another example that my mind can't seem to shake is the morning when Mum had to pop out of the shops. I ended up hiding in my room, cowering under the duvet, while she bellowed at me up the stairs. "I can take everything from you, you trembling little meat sack, you snivelling waste of skin. Just be glad you're too small for anything to notice you." As you'd expect, I'd always burst into tears. Mum and Dad would calm me down, trying to soothe me by explaining ad infinitum that Grandma was old, that she didn't understand what she was doing. By the time of the incident, I was terrified of her. Not just because of the things she'd say directly to me either. The things I caught her saying when she didn't know I was listening creeped me out just as much. "This one's no good. Draws too much attention. Can't move fast. They'll notice. Need more padding around the mouth parts. Think the male and run to spec the teeth. We'll have to be the female. Female past conventional beauty prime. Can blend." These nonsensical ramblings were all pieces of a puzzle I still don't want to put together. I'm not sure I can stand back to take the whole picture once it's finished. Not without snapping, at least. Mum and Dad didn't believe my frantic recollections of the wild and dangerous words I'd ever heard Grandma spouting. They definitely refused to accept my explanation for where the television remote had disappeared to was anything other than a lie to get Grandma out of the house. Because I didn't just catch Grandma saying weird stuff. I caught her eating weird stuff too. It started small. Stray pieces of Lego, old coins she found down the back of the sofa, any lighters or cigarettes Dad was foolish enough to leave laying around. I watched her consume all these at one point or another whenever I was left alone in her care. The TV remote was the last thing that took it too far for me. Kids are much more resilient than adults when it comes to the inexplicable untruths bubbling under the surface of reality. The remote was too much, even for a 7-year-old. Mum and Dad had gone somewhere for the evening. I was sitting cross-legged in front of the telly, trying to lose myself in robot wars and drown out the steady barrage of grotesque threats. We were 4 weeks into the summer by that point. As much as the words unnerved and rattled me, I'd survived enough of them to have built up a smidgen of tolerance. "Here, runt, look at this." Something about her gravelly words was different. They always held undertones of poison, but this time it wasn't the same snakebite venom as usual. This was a different toxicity. Tainted nectar of the kind behemoth rainforest plants use to lure unsuspecting hummingbirds into gaping maws. Taken by surprise, I lowered my guard and turned from the TV. Grandma was leering down at me from a chair. She was holding the TV remote in one hand, the gnarled nails of the other digging into the arm of Dad's chair. On anyone else's face, her shriveled eyes would have sparkled a sadistic malice to match her wide, perfectly symmetrical teeth of that smile. As it was, the dead orb stared at opposite corners of the room. It didn't matter. I knew when Grandma addressed me, it was only the enamel locked in those granite-coloured gums that mattered. "I'm not going to be around much longer, runt," she sneered, words still dripping with Trojan malice. "You'll be pleased to hear that, I'm sure. You pathetic stain on your gene pool. All of them I've encountered, you're the worst." I could feel my bottom lip trembling. As usual, this only seemed to egg her on. "I can't suffer the indignance of this pustule, so undeserving of that skin, walking around this backwater cesspit, not knowing how insignificant they actually are." Before I could start sobbing, before the fluttering in my lungs could evolve into full-blown panic, she lifted the TV remote. I screamed so loudly, the neighbors on both sides yelled, "Keep that damn kid under control." The lower half of her waxy face clicked and shifted. Her jaw extended slowly, the flesh making the groaning, creaking sounds of rubber dragged across a bed of broken glass. For a full half a minute, it jutted and protruded until her chin jutted out a full foot from her neck. The inexplicable gaze from her teeth never left my screaming face as she lowered the remote into a gullet. The cement gums wriggled, puckering and closing the impossibly angular dentistry around her forearm, remote and all, independently of the rest of her motionless face. I continued bawling against the backdrop of neighbourly complaints as the mouth within her mouth suckled and slavered at her buried forearm. She pulled the limb out slowly, white teeth leaving deep and perfectly square imprints on her clay flesh. Not that it would have made any difference to how fast I sprinted up the stairs to my room, but the chunky TV remote in a mucus-covered hand was gone. I refused to leave my room for a week. That was fine by my parents. They didn't believe me anyway, and I was grounded as such. It was exactly 7 days from the remote that I plucked up the courage to, in my mind, get back at Grandma. Because at the end of the week, when she got out of a chair to ascend the stairs to the bathroom for a weekly shower, I made a decision. Grandma was going to be the next unwilling toilet ghost contestant. I'll fully disclose here. I was 7, but I wasn't stupid. I'd seen enough daytime TV to know what a heart attack was, and how you shouldn't shock old people because of them. I knew full well the risks of subjecting a lady as old as Grandma to the levels of jump scare toilet ghosts brought my parents. I have no shame in admitting I knew this. It's the first, and probably only, memory I have of deciding to willingly hurt another human being. But a heart attack was kind of the goal. Dad had gone to work a night shift, leaving Mum and I alone with Grandma. I lay in wait by the hole, listening to the stairs creak under the nightmarish woman's massive bulk. I didn't have any problems with stifled giggling over invasion of privacy this time. My mind was focused, sharp. This round of toilet ghost wasn't a friendly match. I never had the balls to play the game with Grandma. I'd had a lot more practice since my first round against Dad, though. I'd perfected my ghost sounds now. I'd learned how to bend my moans and bounce my haunting whispers off the 10 or so inches of ceramic pipe so well that Mom nearly didn't get her trousers down in time more than once. "Come on, you freakish old coot," I muttered to myself as I heard the click and swing of the bathroom door opening. "Get nice and settled. I'm going to toilet ghost you so bad you wish you never ate that remote." I had to try hard not to breathe too loud. A mix of anticipation, nerves, and anger had me sucking up whole lungfuls through each nostril with every tense shift of my diaphragm. My throat filled with the acrid reek of bleach, and I almost coughed right at the moment she stood in front of the hole while doing something or other at the bathroom sink. She stood for a full 5 minutes, saying nothing and barely moving. I was about to toilet ghost her back into Grandpa Dunn's arms when she took a few steps backwards. The moment her lumbering form came into full view, the cocktail of emotions gave way to one singular, overpowering feeling. Terror. Pure, unbridled terror. I was too scared to scream. I stared, wide-eyed, tears silently falling down my cheeks, while I bit into my hand so hard I could taste the metallic warmth of open wounds. Grandma's head was empty. Blank voids were all that existed behind her lips and eyes. With each quaking step, her head became more and more deflated, until, by the time she stood still, all that existed above her pudgy neck was a near-flat mass of skin. The nightmare I found myself in didn't give time to process this, though. It was already lining up the next traumatic mental image it took me years to repress. As I watched, praying that my whimpers were quiet enough to go unnoticed, Grandma's belly opened. A red, horizontal line unzipped from her left to right flank, an equatorial wound perfectly aligned with a deep crater containing a belly button. The headless torso started to flap and wobble, her mottled arms deflated, a wet sucking sound accompanying the slow decompression of each appendage. Then, in a fluid motion, the quivering torso that remained lifted at the belly slit. Something pushed it away, discarding the unwanted flats of human skin like wet tissue paper. When the memories of the next few moments came flooding back to me last night, I puked for a solid hour. The thing that stepped out of Grandma's skin shivered. Its opaque, stone-grey, gelatinous form pulsated until the residual leg arched left at its base form, occupying its human shell, had flattened. It heaved and rippled as it bloomed to its full height. The grotesque, cylindrical body extended in pulsing spasms until it stood easily at 8 feet tall. Its bulbous head rocked and swayed as it stretched long cramped muscles, the unspeakable anatomy realigning to support the weight of its true form. The head had no eyes, no nose, no features at all on its sleek grey surface, save for one. The mouth. The wide, square-toothed, impossibly perfect angles of that damn mouth. Folds of glistening white flab puckered around the brilliant white teeth. From somewhere deep in its throat, three long greenish tongues, each several inches in diameter, emerged to probe the air. They were several times the total length of that thing that had worn my grandma by the time they were fully extended. Each of the three appendages set about a task. One turned the shower on, and the two others began curling around my grandma's husk. The thing slithered around the room on its slug-like foot, whilst the tongues got to work. A pang of disgust rose in my belly, nausea churning dangerously close to throwing up. I realized with growing horror that, once a week, this blasphemy against the laws of reality had been emerging to clean my grandmother's skin. While I had been sleeping, it had scrubbed and scraped the only remains of the woman who had birthed my mother. The thought that this whole summer I'd been listening to the running water on the other side of the wall while those three tongues defiled and preserved a human flesh suit became too much. I couldn't watch the thrashing, greenish, moor-born limbs any longer. I turned away from the hole, expelling everything I'd eaten that day onto the carpet under my bed. By the time I finished, I was spitting up nothing but flecks of bile. My chest ached, both from the hurling and from the unstoppable pounding of my panicking heart. Shuddering, drawn by that morbid curiosity known only to children and psychopaths, I lifted my head and looked back through the hole. There, staring back at me from only 10 short inches away, was a set of angular, chalk-white teeth. I'd never heard Mum run up the stairs so fast. She damn near threw the door off its hinges when she burst into the room. She tried to yell above my screams to get through to me, but it was no good. I wouldn't stop screeching about Grandma and the bathroom, pointing at the wall and trying to claw my way as far into her embrace as possible. I begged her to run. I begged her so hard, my already hoarse throat started to burn red raw. She didn't scoop me up, carry me downstairs and strap me into the car. She didn't leave a trail of lighter fluid and throw a match through the letterbox as she left. She didn't pick up Dad and drive us as far away from the house as we burned it down and the thing inside it. No, Mom did what all good moms do. She stood up, sat me on the bed, wiped my eyes, and told me how she'd shown me there was nothing to be afraid of. Then, she went into the bathroom. I hid under the duvet the moment I heard her scream. Thankfully, her dying pleas and series of bangs, crashes, and organic ripping, squelching sounds that followed didn't last too long. The silence that followed, that cacophony, was worse. I knew Dad wasn't going to be home until morning. After an hour or two, I decided that I had to look out from under the duvet. I'd almost managed to convince myself that I'd been asleep and that it had been a nightmare. One glance at Mum's twitching silhouette in the doorway was enough to tell me how wrong I was. I was sobbing uncontrollably under the duvet as I heard her shamble over to the bed. I could feel her stood above me for what must have been hours. I could see daylight from the window outside, piercing through the cheap bedding when she finally leant down close to where my ear was. "Remember, runt, if a word of this leaves your filthy parasite lips, we'll know." You can imagine the state Dad found me in when he got back from his shift. You can imagine the state he was in when he'd learned Mom and Grandma had disappeared. They never found remains of either of them. By the time Dad got home, the thing had managed to clean the bathroom. I don't know what it did with Grandma's skin, but the flashbacks of that protruding jaw and square teeth puckered around a forearm gave me a solid guess. They found Mom's car by the coast. Eventually, they gave up looking for a body. I still remember the gentle-mannered police officer consoling my crying father after informing him that they had to assume Mom, overcome with grief over the dementia, had taken Grandma so they could walk out to sea together, swallowed up by the waves as he was with grief. The rest of my life was exactly as you'd expect. Counseling and trauma therapy were a big part of it. I told everyone, especially Dad, what I'd seen. Nobody believed me, which is probably why I've been allowed to live so long. I was told by the army of doctors, therapists, counselors, and the like, that it was a false memory created by my mind to cope with the horrific events that actually took place. For a few happy decades, I managed to believe that too. The truth of that night in my mind throughout my adult life has been that Mom had told me we were going to the coast and had been very upfront about what for. She tried to take me by force and even bit me during a psychotic break. At some point, I passed out from fear. Worrying she'd kill me in her adult state, she then drove off to the coast with Grandma without me. All was going well. After a rocky adolescence and early 20s, I'm 30 now and married, have stable employment, a home, a life, a nice, normal life. At least it was. Until last night. Because last night, when we were watching a news segment about the UN Climate Crisis Summit, I saw them at the back of a crowd of suited dignitaries and politicians. A set of perfectly square, impossibly white teeth, grinning from between pudgy, waxen lips. Pudgy, waxen lips and a face that I recognized. A face that hadn't changed much at all since 1998, aside from a slight graying of the skin and a new, angular smile. It was Mom. The memories came flooding back all at once. Like I said, I puked for an hour. Kath, my wife, was worried. As soon as I could stop retching, I explained it all to her. Grandma, Mom, that smile, the thing that wore both their skins. Kath's jaw dropped. I thank God she believes me, and that, unlike Mom, she's agreed to drive to the remotest place we can find. She's agreed to go off-grid with me, agreed to hide away from the monster she's never seen up close, but knows in her bones is real. Why does she believe me, you ask? Simple. The second, I collapsed into a sobbing heap at my story's climax. My phone buzzed. It was seeing the colour drain from my face faster than she ever had that prompted Kath to snatch it from my hands. Her reaction was worse. I had to hold her for a solid 2 hours once I managed to stop her trying to barricade herself inside the kitchen cupboard. I'd received a picture message from a private number. It was a picture of Kath and I in our living room, taken from right outside the front window. That night, judging by her clothing, with a single sentence attached. "We told you we'd know if you told, runt." I don't think that's what sent her over the edge, though. I think what sent her over the edge is what we also saw in that photo. Our living room runs from the front to the back of the house. If you looked in on our front window, you could see our back garden through the sliding glass doors. What made convincing Kath so easy was that, in the photo, you could clearly see a wide set of white, square teeth leering at the back of her heads from the pitch-black garden. Growing up, I never questioned the strange corn the Abernathy family grew. Every year, it was far taller than any other field anyone had ever seen. The local town folk tried to get the Abernathy family to spill the trick to getting an insane harvest year after year. After a while, the Abernathys stopped going into town. Rumor said it was because the entire family was in poor health for some reason. When one was spotted, they looked sickly and thin. The only member of the family anyone ever saw was Jude. He was a tall, friendly man who always could spare some change or treats for children. My mother told me Jude was distantly related. He would sometimes drop by from time to time to see how our family was doing or to help with chores around the house. I grew up in farm country, less than 1,000 people in town. The house is old and on the verge of falling over. There was nothing for a kid to do on summer break aside from fishing and swimming in the creek. I was so bored near the end of summer. The fields about ready to be harvested in a few short weeks and I would be back in school. I was desperate for anything to do when Jude's truck came down the drive to our small worn-out house. "Ma and Pa aren't here. They're at Auntie's place," I told Jude when he started to get out of the truck. I tried my best to ditch my accent my entire life. I wanted to move away when I was old enough and thought the accent might have people in the city look down on me. Still, some words I stuck to using. It felt disrespectful calling my parents anything but Ma and Pa. "Oh, that's all right. I was coming down to ask you for help. Trick had gone off and got lost in the field again. He's always liked you. Can you help me get him out there?" Jude asked me after I approached his truck. Trigger was an old mutt that I loved. I couldn't have a dog because my ma was allergic. But she let me play with Trigger as much as I wanted outside and made me wash my own clothes so she wouldn't go into any sneezing fits. He was a good dog, but up there in years. Being half blind meant he might be trapped inside the cornfield forever if someone didn't help him out. "Yeah, sure. I got nothing else to do." I nodded and climbed inside the other side of the truck. Jude brought along chocolate bars to share. They half melted in the sun, but to a kid who barely got sweets, they tasted just fine. The roads haven't been repaired for years, so we bumped along to the old Abernathy place. Pulling up the long dirt driveway, I saw an older woman sitting on the porch. She didn't even look over at us. I know I should respect my elders, but she gave me the jitters, just staring off into space like that. For a while, we called for Trigger outside the field, while that old woman sat so very still, not looking at us. She might as well be deaf if she didn't react to the ruckus we made. "I think we gotta go inside and get him," Jude finally said. I agreed. We couldn't get lost if we stuck to the rows in the corn. After all, you just need to walk in one direction long enough and you'll get out of the field eventually. I let Jude lead the way, showing me where he thought he'd seen Trigger earlier. The corn was so tall. I strained my neck trying to see the top when we started to walk along the rows. I knew I was short, but even a fully grown man will be dwarfed by this corn. Since I grew up this field always being so tall, I'd never thought anything was strange about it until I went inside. Taking a few steps in, I noticed how cool it felt compared to the outside of the stalks. I didn't hear any bugs chirping or anything aside from Jude walking in front of me. Sometimes we tried calling for Trigger again while looking to see if he left any tracks for us to follow. I kept walking, calling out every once in a while. We'd gotten pretty far inside the field when I heard a noise. I froze, trying to listen for the sound again. I thought it was rustling somewhere just beyond my line of sight. "Did you hear something?" I asked, staring off into the corn. Jude stopped to listen for a while. When the sound didn't come again, he shook his head. It must have just been the wind. "How old are you going to be this year, Ty?" Jude asked me after a few minutes of walking again. 13, I answered back without a thought of why he was asking. Jude sometimes asks questions for the sake of talking. "That's a good age. You know, back in the day, you would have been an adult by now. You sure have grown a lot in the past few years. Going to be as tall as me soon." I nodded, not really listening or paying any attention of where we were going. For a nearly blind and old as dirt dog, Trigger sure did cover some ground. "Shouldn't we try and head back? Get some food for him to smell and lure him out?" I suggested. "In a few minutes, there is something pretty cool coming up. I wanted to show it you for a while now." Warning bells in my head faintly went off, but I dismissed them. This was Jude, after all. I've known him for my entire life. My parents trusted him, and he'd helped us out a lot in the past. "You know, I got Trigger for you. I heard you wanted a dog, so I adopted him from the old Kelly farm. He'd gotten too old to be a good farm dog, and I stopped them from just dumping him off on the side of the road. I thought if I had him, you might spend more time with me." Something about this felt off. I didn't know the name or the feeling in my stomach. I pushed it down, reminding myself that this was Jude after all, the man who saw me grow up and a distant relative. Nothing was wrong, and I was just a little freaked out being in the weird cornfield the whole town spoke about. Jude paused to turn to me, his cold blue eyes looking over to make sure I was still following. He held out his hand like he had done 1,000 times before, and like all the other times, I reached out to take it without a second thought. We walked a few steps forward to a clearing inside the corn. Seeing an empty space made me realize just how tall the stalks really were. It wasn't natural how high they reached. In the middle of the circle clearing was a chair. A single wooden chair just sitting in front of us, empty. My stomach turned again, and I gripped Jude's hand for comfort before I realized this man was the one who led me to this place. I looked up at him, expecting an answer. He didn't even meet my gaze. "I wish we had more time together, you know. I thought of you as my own little brother. But there isn't anyone else we can get on short notice, and they have been squawking for something to eat." His tone was serious, and I felt my hands start to sweat. I let out a small, nervous laugh, convinced this was some sort of prank. What else would it be? "Jude, this isn't funny. Let's go back," I begged and started to try and take my hand away. He gripped so tightly I couldn't take my hand back. I soon started to panic. Digging my feet into the soft dirt, I used all my weight to pull back to get nowhere. For some reason, they want us to explain a little to the ones we bring over here. The last time we brought someone into the field for them, they didn't say what it was all about. They made the worst kind of ruckus for months. What are you even talking about? My voice was shrill from fear. There are things in the corn. We don't know what they are yet. Only the Abernathy family can give them permission to eat once blood has been spilled. My theory is, the corn is like a hatching ground for them. That's why it's so tall. It keeps them hidden from prying eyes. They appear right as the corn is tall enough to keep them hidden and leave when we need to harvest. We get a plentiful yield every year. At the cost of feeding them. I was still struggling, and my wrist felt like I was going to break it from pulling on it so hard. My entire body felt cold. This man wasn't the Jude I've known my entire life. I didn't know who he was. The person I grew up knowing was a mask that fooled everyone around him. "Please, let me go home," I croaked, hot tears starting to fall. He finally looked down at me, a half smile on his face. My entire body froze up, and I was seconds away from getting sick. The look on his face was as if he was staring down a three-course meal after starving for days. It was a look no one had ever given me before, and one I never wanted to see again. "Before they come for you, how about you spend some time with me?" he asked, still with that awful smile on his face. Being a child, I didn't understand what he could have planned. All I knew is I was terrified. I thought back of school, trying to think of any advice teachers gave me to deal with a situation like this. They said if a strange man approached you, to run and get an adult, or scream. Screaming would do nothing, and I couldn't get my hand free. Not wanting any of what he was going to do, I let myself turn completely feral. I screamed and thrashed, trying to get away. Jude looked confused, and he reached a hand towards me to hold me still. I snapped at him, missing the first time. The second time, my teeth sank into flesh. My screams muffled, but his rang out through the field. He shook, trying to get me off. I knew when he did, he might hurt me. I kept my mouth clamped down hard as I tried kicking at his shins. I'll admit, I didn't have a plan beyond doing as much damage as I could, then running. Giving up on trying to pry me off, he gave me a sharp smack, trying to get me to release his bleeding hand. My head was swimming and I was dizzy. Any second now, he would start hitting harder, and I needed to decide whether to let go and run or not. My rescue came in the form of something I never expected. Trigger came bolting out from the other side of the clearing, barking his head off. He jumped at Jude and latched onto his leg. Now he had me biting his hand and Trigger thrashing and ripping his pants. The old dog had never even barked before. He liked Jude, and I never imagined he would attack him, or anyone for that matter. I was beyond thankful. With some regret, I let go, tasting blood in my mouth. Turning on my heels, I ran down to where we had come from as fast as my legs would carry me. I didn't want to leave Trigger behind, but I had no choice. I hoped he would be safe until I could come back with some help. Running through the corn, the stalk slapped my face. I could hear Jude screaming and cursing up a storm behind me. He used words I'd never heard before, and if my mother was there, she would beat him down for such language in front of a child. My chest strained against my fast pace. I didn't understand it. We hadn't really walked that far. I should be seeing a way out by now. I covered a lot of ground, and yet I didn't see where the corn stopped. Suddenly, my foot caught, and I tripped, falling hard. Panting, I sat up, and my body tensed when I heard something close by walking around. I tried being as silent as I could, hoping I wouldn't be seen through the stalks, when a wet, cold feeling bumped against my back. I was too scared to even scream. My heart beat frantically when a flood of relief came surging through my body. Trigger found me, somehow getting away from Jude without any injuries. I pressed my face into his fur, giving silent thanks for him saving me. Slowly, trying my very best not to make any noise, I started along through the massive stalks, fully aware of every sound around me. Trigger stayed matching my pace, and I kept a hand on his back so he knew I was still there and not going to leave him. Aside from being scared, I was so angry. Jude had been family. The entire time, he was just pretending. For what? Were there really things in the corn wanting blood, or was Jude just crazy? I wanted answers, but I mostly wanted to get the hell out of there to find an adult I could trust to take Jude in. As the time passed, I sweated through my shirt in fear. I was getting closer to a sound I recognized. A clucking sound. I didn't think the Abernathy family kept chickens. I still went closer to the sounds, hoping it led to the way out. Keeping walking forwards, I only saw more corn. Trigger stopped us. The hair on his back stood, and he grew tense. A very low growl came from him, and I frantically started to look around, seeing if Jude found us. That's when I saw it. Something I'm not entirely certain of what it was to this day. Jude wasn't lying. There was something in the corn. The thing was massive, somewhat hidden in the stalks. It was a dark red. So dark, it was nearly black. I darted a few feet away from me, back further into the field. At first, I didn't think I'd seen anything. The stress was getting to me, and I was just imagining things. Until I looked over my shoulder behind me, and then looked up. Staring down at me was a pair of red eyes belonging to the biggest bird I've ever seen. And yet, it wasn't a bird. A sharp, powerful beak looked as if it could crack bones. It was bird-shaped, but birds simply were not that big. It wasn't as tall as the corn, but it still was nearly triple my height. It was the same deep red color as the one I'd briefly seen. The sunlight reflected off his feathers, giving them an oily shine. I swallowed, trying to wet my dry throat. The thing moved its head around, looking at me. I was too scared to even move. Finally, it raised its head towards the sky and opened its beak, letting out a deafening screech that sounded like a horrible mixture between a train horn and a goose. Soon, the same sound joined it, coming from all sides around me. There wasn't just one of these creatures. And Jude did say they were hungry. To make my look so much worse, he found us. I stood, shaking, looking up at the massive bird creature when movement caught my eye. I saw him limping towards me. He was injured, but all hope still left me. I couldn't escape him and these birds. "There you are. Christ, you really shouldn't have run. Now that they found you, all I gotta do is say the word. You just needed to stay in the clearing with me. I would have needed to feed you to them at some point, but at least you could have lived for a few hours." Even being surrounded by monsters, Trigger was brave enough to growl. That got some of my strength back. I glared at him, hated him for planning on feeding me to these birds. Looking at his bloody hand, I wondered if I could outrun him injured. I couldn't outrun these bird creatures if he decided not to chase after me and told them I was fair game. Then, an idea came to me. I looked up again at the massive dark creature. It met my eyes, both of us thinking the same thing. Jude said that only his family could tell these creatures to eat, and we were related in some way. It was worth trying. "You can have him," I told the creature, looking over at Jude with hate in my eyes. His face grew pale. He took a few steps away from me, realizing what I'd just done. Shaking his head, it was his turn to be too frightened to speak. He raised a hand in front of himself, as if it could protect him from what was going to happen. Slowly, more and more of those creatures came. Despite their size, they moved silently through the field. Jude was surrounded, and none of them were looking in my direction. The moment before those massive creatures bolted forwards to claim their meal, I turned away, unable to watch. I heard the sounds, though. He screamed. For a few seconds. Then a gargling sound, before horribly ripping and crunching. As I kept walking, those monsters squawked and screeched out to all the others hidden in the corn. I found my way out after a long while of walking. I was not going to risk asking for help by the house, so I walked a few miles back into town. My parents discovered I was missing at that point, and most of the small population was looking for me. I was returned to my parents, with Trigger coming with me, mind frozen in shock. I didn't even speak to tell them what happened for a few hours. When it did all come out, it came in heavy sobs. My parents were unable to make sense of what I was saying through the tears. Beside, Jude took me to the cornfield, and he was dead. For a few years, I was never able to tell them the full story. After all, who would believe me? I fully planned on moving away the moment I could from that horrible small town. A year before I moved, someone else must have figured out what the family was doing. I never heard of any deaths of missing people, but the corn still grew tall every year. That family was still feeding those creatures, and I couldn't do anything. No one knew who it was, but someone set fire to the field. The blaze ripped through the corn, burning everything to the ground. Other farmers had their property untouched. The fire only remained on the Abernethy's land. I was so glad to see it. Then, the start of summer, just before I left, I looked at the property for the last time. Corn plants already sprouting and healthy from the ground, as if there never was any fire damage to the soil a year before. I wanted to do something, but the large family that once owned the largest crop of corn was failing. Each year, members died peacefully in their sleep or went missing. Someday soon, they would not remain, and I very much hoped, once they died out, the unnatural corn went with them. I can still remember the smell of pine needles and wild flowers that perfumed the air around a small little homestead. Like something out of Snow White, Grandma's quaint little log cabin puffing up smoke signals from its old stone chimney would appear enchanting. However, the impenetrable wall of woodland encircling it was eerily still and silent, with very little light peeping through the evergreen. Up until that point in my life, I'd never stayed with Grandma. She'd always come to visit us and stay in my parents' home, but due to my folks separating and on the verge of a messy divorce, I was sent to spend some time with her. Whilst they worked out whatever it was they had to work out. Upon stepping out of the car, my small Converse sank in the wet, muddy pathway and squelched the way up to the front door. The porch was covered in funny-looking dreamcatchers and wind chimes made with crystals, adding a little more magic to the place. But still, I would have much preferred to have been at home, playing out with my friends. All the negativity I had towards the place, though, quickly disappeared as she opened the door. I remember the smell of freshly brewed tea poured out from the kitchen behind her and wrap around me as she hugged me tight. Her embrace was warm like hot cocoa on a snowy winter's day, and she was quick to assure me that everything was going to be fine, and that she was going to look after me, and we were going to have so much fun. My father, on the other hand, spared no words for me, and upon handing me over, sped off back to battling my mother over home ownership and custody. Grandma led me inside, and my eyes widened with wonder at the funny ornaments and old-worldy paintings of pixies by the lake, not far from her homestead. Those days I spent with her were my sanctuary from those constant raised voices and unpleasant screaming matches that I'd suffered for years. With Grandma, there were no rows or arguments. Instead, I spent my days playing with my figures, listening to fairy tales by a roaring log fire, and waking up to freshly cooked pancakes. I got to play out too, but under her watchful gaze as she sat on the porch, knitting and humming some funny tune from times long past. There were a few rules, but one of them was that I could not leave her sight when I was outside, and that I was to never go into the woods. She always reminded me that there were dangerous animals in there, and that people had a habit of getting lost because of how densely packed it was. Her concerns were justified, as that's what happened to my grandpa, you see. He suffered from dementia, and one day he wandered off and was never found. Despite that, my gran never seemed to show a sadness, always smiling, always happy. For a while, things were normal, peaceful and mundane. Until one night, when I was drifting between dreams, there came a noise beckoning me awake. Tap, tap, tap. That's the noise that awoke me. Tap, tap, tap. It wasn't my heavy-handed father hammering through the door, nor was it the calm drip of water droplets slipping from the faucet in the bathroom. The sound was gentle, yet direct, and it was coming from the window beside my bed. Turning over, I flicked the small lamp on and plucked my glasses from the bedside. I blinked once, twice, maybe three times to adjust my half-awake vision, only for my sight to be met by a surprise. Just an inch or two away from the glass, I saw her old, wrinkly face smiling from outside my window. It was my gran, peering in at me. Her face was whiter than usual, a sort of papery look to it, ashen, pale, and drowning in the silvery moonlight. Though most of her was shrouded in darkness, I could see her face clearly, smiling her shriveled-lipped grin as she tapped upon the glass pane and pointed downward in an eager motion. She was trying to tell me to unlock the window, and though it seemed strange, she was my grandma. So, when she said that, I did what any small child would do. I reached over to the window, unhooked the window's latch, and went to move it. However, when I did, the window wouldn't budge. She still tapped on the window with her long bony fingers. I hadn't noticed how unusually long they were before that, and they seemed to have many joints, with each digit ending in discolored, cracked nails. I tried to open the window again, but it wouldn't budge. Looking closer, I noticed that there were nails hammered into the window, fixing it shut. I shook my head, and when I did, her smile shrank, and she herself stepped away from the glass and slowly disappeared into the veil of shadows outside. My need for sleep was too great, and despite the strange behavior of my grandmother, I just couldn't keep my eyes open, and before I knew it, I blinked and the night was gone. Like every other day, the golden rays of sun warmed my face and the sweet syrup-soaked pancakes my gran had made called to me. Walking across the oaken floorboards, I could hear her humming her funny songs and tunes while pouring herself a cup of tea. Weirdly, she was acting as if last night had never happened, and I was quick to notice that her fingers were different to last night. They were dainty and normal, covered in gem-studded rings. I was only half a pancake into my stacked breakfast feast when I asked her what she was doing outside last night, and why she wanted me to let her in through my window. Tea sloshed over the cup edge, and for a second, her controlled and gingerly pouring of the hot beverage was startled. "What do you mean?" she asked, her words shivering slightly. I told her that I tried to let her in last night, but couldn't, and that it wasn't my fault because the windows were nailed shut. Her whole demeanor changed the moment I spoke, and a joyful tone of the homestead came to an abrupt halt. Turning to me, she asked if I was certain I'd seen her last night, and that it wasn't just a dream. I nodded and told her I was definitely awake, not realizing that such an answer was not welcome. Looking back, I see now she wasn't just anxious. She was afraid. though, as a young boy, I knew not of her fears or the truth behind such a question. My grandmother stammered her next words, and her face seemed to shrink and shrivel a little as she feverishly fumbled over every sentence that came from her mouth. "You must promise me you won't do anything if you see me outside at night. I sleepwalk, and sometimes I will do things that are strange, and if I ask you to let me in or to come outside, then ignore me. I will be fine if you just leave me outside. But if you let me in or talk even, I might wake up with a fright, and that can be bad for sleepwalkers, okay? So promise me you will just ignore me if I come by your window at night." She rattled off, her voice seeming to become unable to speak properly. So, I did as I was told, for the most part. Every night, I would see my gran tapping at each and every window in the house. She'd do silly things on the other side of the glass. She'd pull faces and make shadow puppets in the moonlight. Sometimes she'd like to hide, skipping into the darker, unlit tree line, hiding behind the trunks, before jumping up from beneath the window ledge, giving me such a fright. She'd silently chuckle and belly laugh at my reactions, but then she'd always return to gesturing for me to open the window, or to unlock one of the doors. However, other than laughing at her silly behaviour outside the window, I did as my gran told me, and never tried to let her in. I began to get a strange feeling about my grandmother. At night, she seemed so different, and I'd noticed unsettling things about her body. For instance, one night when I looked outside, I saw her hunched over, digging and scratching at the wood of the house just below the living room window, and in the sliver of starlight radiance, I could see she was unclothed and her emaciated skeletal body just looked wrong. Her arms and legs were way too thin and long for starters, and there was something on her back. Actually, it was a pair of things that I couldn't make out because they buzzed and moved too quickly for my eyes to define them. When morning would come, I'd convince myself that the strange features, the protruding spine and the wind-like things buzzing in her back were nothing but the dark, playing tricks in my mind or a strange dream brought on by my strange time spent at the homestead. Still, there was something off about her. She seemed quieter and had even stopped humming during the day. My gran became short-tempered with me, stopped telling me fairy tales, and was quick to shut down any questions I had. Yet at night, she appeared happily dancing and performing outside, only to grow sad when I refused to let her in. I didn't want to wake her in the middle of her sleepwalking. She told me that would be bad and could even be dangerous for her health. And it seemed my grandmother was telling the truth about sleepwalking, because she always had her eyes shut when she was outside at night. And if that part was true, then I knew I had to listen to her about not trying to talk to her or let her in. On my last night, I was there though. I broke my promise. Earlier that day, I had been playing outside with my G.I. Joes and had lost one of my favourite ones in the grassy clearing that the homestead sat upon. We looked everywhere for it, but to no avail. Then, when night came once more, there was a tapping at my window, and I looked to see her standing there, smiling. The smile was wider than before, almost ear to ear, though I couldn't see her ears. My grandmother walked around the house, and I followed her, until we got to the door, and she motioned to the 6 individual bolts, keeping it shut tight. I shook my head, and she frowned, and sulked a smile into an upset expression, before revealing her hand, the action figure I'd lost. Instantly, her expression became one of delight, and she grinned. She offered it to me, and gestured for me to open the door once again. But I shook my head, and she instead placed the toy in the porch. Slowly, she stepped back into the shadows, and disappeared entirely into the night, leaving my toy just slightly out of reach. I remember staring through the kitchen window at my favourite toy, and somewhere inside me, my foolish desire for a chunk of plastic overruled my grandmother's words. Though I was too small to reach the top bolts of the door, I retrieved a footstool and used that to give me some height. One bolt came undone quickly and quietly. The other slowly squeaked as its rusted metal shunted back. Then I loosened the lower bolts and took the key hanging on the wall and unlocked the kitchen door. Carefully, I peeled the door open, slowly, scoping the area and making sure not to be seen by my sleepwalking gran out of fear of being told off for breaking the rules. Thankfully, she was nowhere to be seen, and I quickly yanked the toy from the wooden boards on the porch and rushed back inside. To be honest, however, any concern I had for that, or being caught, disappeared when I walked past my gran's room and saw through the partially open door that she was sleeping soundly. She must have gotten in through the back door or gone back to sleep, something which I was eager to do. Tiredness took hold, and upon placing my head on the pillow, I did not awake to the humming of my grandmother, nor the scent of warm pancakes with syrup rose me from my slumber. Instead, I was rudely awoken, shook back into consciousness by my dad, who, with a frantic look in his face, asked me where my gran was. I told him everything that had been happening, the sleepwalking, the strange behavior at night, and he decided to call law enforcement. To the best of my ability, I recounted the previous night's events, explaining how my grandmother was outside and I saw her disappear into the woods. Despite officers reassuring us that she would be found, an awful sense of dread filled my heart when my dad told them that the kitchen door was unlocked when he came in. This was all my fault, because in my urgency to avoid being told off or caught breaking my grandmother's rules, I had forgotten to lock the door behind me. Without hesitation, I interrupted their conversation and exclaimed my guilt. I told them that I'd left the door unlocked, but that my grandmother was in bed when I walked back to my room. My dad looked confused and asked how she could have been in bed, if I had seen her outside only moments before that. The penny finally dropped, and even my naive young mind understood what had been happening. My grandmother didn't sleepwalk. There were two people who looked the same. One inside the house with me, and the one outside in the woods at night. I tried to tell them that I might have let someone in, that my grandmother had a twin outside. But who'd believe such a thing, especially from a confused little boy who was probably just dreaming or overcome with worry for his gran. They never did find her. Another victim of undiagnosed dementia, just like my grandfather before her. My father is gone now. I've inherited my grandmother's homestead through his will. I truly believe that, as an adult, coming back here would help, that it would bring me some sort of closure to the whole thing and help me make sense of it all. Yet, I'm left with more questions now. For every night, I'm awoken, not by my grandmother knocking on the window. No, now when I look up and gaze through the thin glass pane, I see myself, pale-faced, smiling, and always gesturing to be let in. I sat against the red and brown brick wall outside the police station, knees tucked into my chest. My heavy breaths clouded in front of me as the cold winter air bit my skin, making my fingers numb, but I didn't care. The cold air provided me with the only sense of peace that I could find right now. Just yesterday, I was a normal teenage kid living a normal teenage life with normal parents who loved me. Today, everything I thought I knew about my life was shattered. My family, the Antonovs, always boasted proud Russian heritage. My grandparents on both sides of the family migrated from the USSR when they were just children. My father always told me dramatic versions of the stories of his grandfather, Maxim Antonov. Maxim migrated to the United States with his family, only $6.55 in his pocket. However, we knew very little about our family genealogy past Maxim, thanks to their town being completely destroyed in the war. With all these new DNA genealogy tests now readily available, I thought it would be fun to surprise my parents by getting a more detailed picture of our true ancestry. I researched these test kits for hours, and I was amazed. I just knew my parents would love this, so I secretly purchased the test kit with the money I made raking leaves and shoveling snow. I went to the store with my cash and change. I handed the cashier my wrinkly, disorganized bills, mostly with fives, tens, and ones in them. The bored cashier gave me a noticeable sigh, but counted the money out anyway, before handing me a receipt and a small firm box. Out of the box, I pulled a small tube in sterile packaging. I filled the tube to the line with clear, bubbly spit. Then I sealed the enclosed, pre-labeled box and dropped it off at the nearest blue postal drop box. The results took a long time. I checked my email regularly, hoping to see a notification that my results were ready to view. I grew impatient waiting. It had been 3 weeks, then 4 weeks, then 5 weeks. Finally, 5 weeks and 6 days later, during online school, I got the notification. Your DNA genealogy test results are ready to view. I hurried to the website and typed the keys so fast that I entered my password incorrectly, not once, but twice. Finally, my account opened up. I eagerly opened the genealogy chart, excited to bring incredible insight and clarity to my family. When I opened the results, however, I found only confusion instead of clarity. There wasn't any Russian listed at all. The color-coded bullet points showed that I'm 62% Scottish, 11% Welsh, 10% German, 8% Italian, 5% Arabic, and 4% Indigenous American. Not even a fraction of Russian heritage was listed. The detail map showed coloured migration patterns on my alleged ancestors dating back to the 1700s, but not a single one of those coloured dotted lines touched Soviet land. I was so confused and disappointed. I thought I would be getting a detailed explanation as to my family's genealogy, but instead, I just found a bunch of mumbo-jumbo that didn't add up. I figured if there was one person who might be able to explain this one, it would be my father. I was disappointed that I couldn't give him the awesome surprise that I'd hoped for, but now I was the one who needed answers. So I walked into his home office and confessed what I did, and asked why my genealogy wasn't Russian. My father was rarely a person to be quick to anger, but when I showed the unusually calm and collected man the results, his face turned red and his lips twisted into a grimace as if he had just drank sour milk. I had never in my life seen him so livid, waving his arms around with spit droplets flying from his mouth with each word he yelled. After 30 minutes of listening to this terrifying rant about how those tests were fake and unreliable, an outright scam according to him, my father demanded that I disable my account and never speak of it again. Never in my life had I ever felt so let down. I was just trying to make my family proud and could not understand why my dad was so mad. Alas, I disabled my account, deleting it all, and walked back to my room, staring at the ground with slumped shoulders. The ensuing days felt weird and awkward at home with my dad, so I barricaded myself in the sanctuary of my room to avoid any contact with him. He did the same. My mom got weird too after my dad undoubtedly told her what I did. I could feel her avoiding eye contact with me. They even confiscated my cell phone. Finally, it was Monday, one of the 2 days each week that I had in-person schooling. I was relieved to hop on my bike and ride away from my now tense home, away from the trauma and tension. As I arrived at school and talked to my friends, I finally found relief and felt like myself again. That, however, would not last long. It was only the first period when I was called to the office. I'd never been called to the office before, so I nervously collected my things, dropping my books in front of my entire class. I strode quickly to the administrative offices, my heart beating through my chest, The second I walked through those doors, I found two police officers looking at me intently.
"Are you Max Antonov?" asked one of the officers.
Yeah. Who are you?"
I replied, nervously, with my thumbs circling each other in front of me. I had never been in trouble at school, let alone in trouble with the police. My mind raced at the possibilities of where I could have gone wrong. Maybe, I thought, it was my frequent jaywalking. The officer must have noticed my worried expression. "Don't worry, you're not in any trouble," he assured me, leaning down to appear less threatening. "My name is Detective Reynolds, and this is my partner, Detective Carter." He gestured to the female officer beside him. "We need to have a word with you, at the station."
"Why, is everything okay? Was there an accident?"
I asked quickly, as my mind now raced with the thought that my parents must have had a tragic accident.
"There's no emergency," Detective Carter chimed in, showing a gentle smile. "This is concerning a cold case. We'll explain more down at the station."
I was concerned, but I could tell that whatever was going on was serious. I obliged and followed the detectives out to their car. Detective Reynolds was kind enough to grab my bike and attach it to the car's bike rack. Finally, we arrived at the station. I was guided to a room in the back. It wasn't an interrogation room, but an office with a couch and a few chairs. I sat down on the couch next to Carter as Reynolds pulled up a chair and sat in front of me. I couldn't help but feel like they were being a little too sympathetic, making sure that I was comfortable and offering me soda and snacks. "We need to talk to you about your DNA test that you submitted to a DNA genealogy company," said Detective Reynolds, sitting back in a chair right in front of me. His arms rested on the backrest while he nervously tinkered with his wedding ring. "This may seem like a shock, but your profile matches a murder victim in a local cold case." He took a long, deep breath before dropping the bomb. "Max, I really don't know how to explain this to you, but according to your DNA profile, the victim could be your biological mother."
"Oh, that's not possible," I assured him. "I saw my mom this morning."
Detective Carter called on to Reynolds' struggle to explain the touchy situation and interjected herself in a calm and reassuring tone. She gave me a gentle squeeze on my shoulder and looked me in the eyes. "Max, the victim was found murdered and a 3-week-old baby was missing and never found. That crime happened on January 6th, 2003, which is the date you listed as your birthday." Detective Reynolds wiped his forehead before finally looking up to make eye contact with me. The way he was looking at me, as if I was a wounded pet, showed that he certainly believed his twisted theory. "Look, I know this is a lot, but we'd like to take your footprints and a confirmation DNA sample so we can compare them to the footprints on the birth certificate of the missing baby, as well as DNA retrieved from the baby's pacifier." All I could do was nod. A forensics officer came into the room and swabbed both my cheeks with long Q-tips. After that, she pulled out a kit that she used to get my footprints. Hours passed as I waited for the results. I felt a pressure in my chest as I paced the room, sat on the couch, then paced the room again. I even tried to read a magazine, but I couldn't read more than 2 sentences without my mind drifting off into its habitual overthinking, which was now turbocharged. There had to be a mistake. I was certain that the company had accidentally swapped my DNA with someone else, and that was the reason for all of this confusion. But what if? The officer said they were rushing the tests, but it felt like I was pacing that room for days on end. Finally, Reynolds and Carter walked into the room, failing to hide their dismal expressions. He put his hand on my shoulder and gave me a pitiful look. "Son, I'm sorry to say, both the prints and the DNA are a confirmed match." So, that's how I ended up sitting outside the police station with a concerned Detective Carter trying to decide if I need medical care or if fresh air was enough. She kindly guided me outside after I started hyperventilating inside that room. Detective Reynolds was still inside, likely making a plan to arrest my parents, or whoever the hell they were. I looked up to Detective Carter, who awkwardly leaned against the wall with her hands in the pockets. "Do you think I can get a drink of water?" I asked. "Yeah, no problem, Max," she replied, with a gentle smile back in her face. "You just stay right here, and I'll be right back." The second the door closed behind her, I jumped to my feet and ran to the parking lot where my bike was. I hopped on my bike and pedaled as fast as I possibly could toward my house, barely noticing how hard I was breathing. It was only a couple of miles away, so I arrived in maybe 10 minutes, fueled by panic and adrenaline. My dad's car wasn't there, but I knew my mother was at least home. I sprinted upstairs and burst into a room, sending the door slamming into the wall and bouncing back at me. She looked up from her book, taken aback by my boisterous entrance and heavy breathing. "Is everything okay, Max?" she asked. I came to confront her, but now that we were face to face, I stuttered through words, not sure how to start this conversation. Finally, still panting, I blurted out, Did you kill my mother?" Her eyes widened in shock, but then her expression quickly changed to a mixture of sadness and sympathy. "I am your mother, Max," she told me quietly. "Then why?" I started to yell, before taking a deep breath and resuming in a more controlled tone. "Then why did the police just match my DNA to the kidnapped baby of a murder victim?" Her face perked at the mention of the police. "The police? You called the police?" she said, panicked as she walked across the room to close the curtains. "No, they found me." She hurried to a nightstand, from which she retrieved her silver revolver. "We need to leave right now, Max. Get in the car." "You need to tell me the truth," I yelled, this time unable to remain composed. My hands and legs were shaking, and my chest felt heavy and tight again. My mom froze, as the police sirens were now audible in the distance. They were coming our way, and quickly. "You want the truth?" she asked, as the sirens slowly grew louder and the neighborhood dogs joined in. "Well, here's the truth." She stepped closer and leaned toward me, clutching the gun with a finger on the trigger. I suddenly realized that I may have put myself in a situation with a murderer. Obviously, I didn't know this woman the way I thought. Could she kill me, too? "That woman was not your mother. She was a worthless herring tweaking whore." She practically spat the last word out, not even attempting to hide her spite. "We tried for years to have a baby, but we couldn't. Meanwhile, that woman was blessed with a beautiful baby." She took another step closer, as I took a step backward. The sirens were now right in front of the house, sending red and blue flashes through the windows. An intercom buzzed with orders for my parents to step out of the house with their hands up. "We found you, just a baby, crying in the backseat of a freezing car with a soiled diaper." Her expression softened as her eyes changed from anger to sadness. "The woman who gave birth to you was passed out in the front with a goddamn needle sticking out of her arm." She took a deep breath and grabbed my hand with hers. "So yeah, we did what we had to do to save you. We gave you a far better life than you ever would have had if we left you there. We've always loved you, as if you were our own." Tears now streamed up both of our faces, as a boom of the front door being kicked down cracked through the house, signaling the entrance of the police. As I fell to the ground sobbing, my mother stood up and looked at me with the arguable love that she felt for me. "Never forget who your real mother is. You are my son, and I love you, Max." Those were the last words she ever said to me. As the police headed up the stairs, she charged them with a revolver still in her hand. The gunshots rang through the house, followed by the thud of a body hitting the ground. Detective Carter found me in my mother's room, sobbing and hyperventilating again. She grabbed me in her arms and embraced me in a way that was both sympathetic and somehow understanding. With surprising strength, she picked me up in her arms, carrying my 160-pound self out of the house after covering my head with a jacket. Detective Carter, whose first name is Michelle, took me to the hospital and stayed by my side through the night and well into the next morning. My father was arrested not too long after. I've asked to speak with him, but so far his lawyer won't allow it. They did allow me to go to my mother's funeral, though. Thankfully, Michelle accompanied me. None of the people that I once thought were my family members so much as looked my way. I realized that day that I was now alone, without family. At the end of the funeral, Michelle handed me a beautiful bouquet of royal blue roses. She gave me an understanding nod to my unspoken emotions. As I placed the flowers in the casket, I whispered, "I love you too, Mom."